From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we know it's dangerous, but it doesn't stop some people texting and driving.
The 38-year-old man goes, that teenage girl, she's a danger. But me, I'm not a danger. I've been driving for 20 years.
Plus, school leaders in Detroit start to shake off state control. What will it mean for struggling schools?
Starting off at Detroit public schools, and ultimately they are supposed to have responsibility for the lowest 5% of schools across the state.
And the big three roaring back?
I'm not big on government bailouts, I assure you, but I think it's so important to see this tremendous comeback.
A salute to the Detroit Three carmakers, and we'll get the latest on One Tribe's fight to build a casino in Lansing. Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, texting and driving. We know how dangerous it can be, but many of us continue to do it anyway. What is it about our daily lives that makes it so hard to put those phones down and drive? And the fight over a new casino in Lansing continues. We'll find out what's at stake. But first, 1 week ago, Michigan voters said no to Public Act 4. And in doing so, they tossed out the state's controversial emergency manager law. And now the proverbial shoes are beginning to drop, starting in Detroit, trying to shake off state control, beginning with the troubled Detroit schools. Last night, the Detroit Board of Education voted to break their contract and pull out of the Education Achievement Authority, the EAA. If that happens, it could doom the EAA, which was set to provide educational intensive care to struggling schools not only in Detroit, but all around Michigan. It was only last year that Governor Snyder announced plans for the Educational Achievement Authority, a statewide school district for Michigan's underperforming schools. So the EAA only began this school year. Joining us now is Michelle Richard. She specializes in educational issues at Public Sector Consultants. And Don Heller is Dean of the College of Education at Michigan State University. Hello to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don, I want to start by having you explain for us just what the Education Achievement Authority is. How is it supposed to help struggling schools?
Well, the idea behind it, Cynthia, is that it's supposed to provide more autonomy to schools by giving them self-governance and allowing them to free themselves from the constraints of local school districts. They're starting off in the Detroit public schools, and ultimately they are supposed to have responsibility for the lowest 5% of schools across the state who are the lowest performing. And so they will be what some are calling a virtual school district with schools all across the state at some point.
There does seem to be just some confusion, even in how it's termed. Michelle, the state website calls it the EAS, Education Achievement System, and yet we also see Education Achievement Authority. Is it one of the same, and where's this confusion coming from?
From my perspective, they're one and the same. I think the clarification has to do with the EAS is the actual system, and the EAA refers to the district itself. I see them used interchangeably, so I wouldn't focus on that distinction.
Fair enough. And in a sense, what's gained by taking a school and unplugging it from, let's say, this initial burst of schools, unplugging it from the Detroit School Board and making it more autonomous? How do the students win with that?
Well, the theory behind it is similar to the theory behind charter schools, Cynthia, that by giving schools more autonomy, they can be more creative, more innovative, have more control over the hiring of teachers and administrators, and that's supposed to be what will increase their performance over time. The research on charter schools is very mixed. Some of them perform very well and increase student achievement. Some of them perform not as well as the public schools. So, like much about education, I think the devil is in the details. And to be fair to the Education Achievement Authority, they're just 2 months into their work, so it's really too early to tell how well they're performing.
It would seem to me the way it's being described, Michelle, does this sound right? Is the EAA not unlike an emergency manager for troubled schools?
Well, I think the focus for the EAA is almost purely academics. I mean, no doubt there is a financial aspect because you are indeed taking the foundation allowance for a student and moving it to the EAA, right? You need some way to fund that district. Emergency managers, emergency financial managers have been spending most of their time focusing on the financial aspects of the district. And yes, they have focused as well on some academics, but EAA is spending all of its time trying to create a system that can really support student learning.
Now, the teachers hired for schools in the EAA would not be union members. So how is this sitting with the teachers' union?
Well, you know, they don't have to be members of the teachers' union, but they also, once the teachers are in the schools, my understanding is that they will have the right to form a collective bargaining association if they want. I can't speak for the teachers' union, but certainly, in general, teachers' unions have been resistant to the charter school movement because their concern is that it takes jobs away from union members, and in most cases, charter school teachers are not unionized, so there's some legitimacy there to their concern.
How is it that if Detroit does pull out, and this was just kind of begun last night, but if Detroit would pull out, why could that doom the whole EAA? Why couldn't the rest of the state just go ahead without the city of Detroit's participation?
Well, I think that they could in the long term. My biggest concern is in the short term and in lending legitimacy to the effort. I think that particularly among families and children who are currently enrolled in EAA schools, I think this just causes more confusion about whether or not that educational option will be available long term. The legislature currently is looking at codifying the EAA, and they're looking at bills in both the House and the Senate to how we would continue the work of EAA and expand this effort statewide.
For someone listening who has a child in an underperforming school anywhere in Michigan, realizing that this could spread outward and encompass the state, so basically you have kind of a statewide recovery school district, what would that mean to my child sitting there in third grade in this school where kids have not been performing well?
Well, it's a good question, Cynthia, and I think right now there's still obviously a lot of uncertainty over what direction the EAA will take, particularly when it moves into schools outside of Detroit. So, I think that there's just at this point a great deal of uncertainty, and you know, there as the other person said, there is a lot of discussion in the legislature about trying to codify the EAA. And until all of these details get nailed down, I think the reality is you've got parents who will have a great deal of uncertainty about what the future will hold for their schools.
And that said, we did see some parents come up to Lansing in the past week or so and testify before the education committees and talk about their positive experience with EAA. Now, no doubt you will find critics as well, but I think that having a very student-centered approach is something that has resonated with some parents and families, as we've seen by families actually enrolling in EAA schools. They did have the option to consider a different option within Detroit, be it a Detroit public school or a different charter school. And there were a lot of families, about 10,000 students is the current estimate, that did decide to enroll in an EAA school.
Now, as we saw today's Detroit News is reporting on this move last night with the Board of Education in Detroit, voting to break the contract with Eastern Michigan University and pull out of the EAA, that is undoubtedly going to start setting up a tug of war between the board and the state and DPS Emergency Financial Manager Roy Roberts. And I noted that the board president, Lamar Lemon, says everything is for the benefit of the children. So my question to both of you is, how do you think pulling out of the EAA impacts the kids in those struggling schools in Detroit? And then looking outward, if it derails the program throughout Michigan, students in other schools?
Well, I think the challenge, Cynthia, for students and parents in Detroit is there has been so much change going on there. There's been, you know, the creation of the EAA, and now, as you say, the board is saying they want to pull out of the EAA. And so that means more change potentially for students if they go forward with that. Detroit's also set up this fall a group of self-governing schools that's another form of school management within the Detroit Public Schools. So I think it's been a challenge for parents and students in Detroit with all the changes going on. And you know, of course, most parents want the best for their students, and it's very difficult for them to negotiate through understanding all of these different school structures and what's going to be best for their children.
Particularly seeing posturing and in statements and people maybe puffing up a little bit for the cameras and the microphones?
Well, I can't, you know, I can't comment on that. I you know, all I've seen is what's in the Detroit Free Press, so I can't comment
sure
on the motivations of the school board, but you would hope that they would have the best interests of students at heart.
Michelle?
I agree with Dean Heller. I mean, the school district, EAA, parents, families, everyone is working towards providing a stable school environment for children. We know that kids learn best when they know what to expect and there's some stability in their school. And I think that pulling kids out of their current EAA school is a challenge for them, especially as Dean Heller said, because there's been so much uncertainty in the system in the past few years. I think that as we saw in the Detroit news, there were a lot of folks encouraging caution and kind of moving slowly through both implementing EAA and reconsidering whether or not Detroit Public Schools should be participating in the EAA. And I think that being cautious is beneficial for all of our children.
What do both of you think we should be watching for now in the next couple months as this story unfolds?
Well, you know, certainly whether the board is able to go ahead and cancel their contracts with the EAA, because if the Detroit Public Schools pulls out of the EAA, I think there's going to be a major blow to Roy Roberts and to Governor Snyder. So I think that's going to be the critical piece, is whether DPS is able to pull out of the EAA or not.
In addition to that, I'd be watching Governor Snyder's support. I know he had his spokespeople out in the press supporting EAA and the ability of EAA to continue to operate Detroit schools. And I'll be interested to watch his support in the next few months.
Don Heller is Dean of the College of Education at Michigan State University, and Michelle Richards specializes in educational policy at Public Sector Consultants. Thanks to both of you for talking with us today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
My pleasure.
Meanwhile, Benton Harbor's emergency financial manager says he'll discuss the city's financial situation next week, this after voters rejected an operating millage in last week's election. Some elected city leaders urged people to vote against the millage because they don't believe emergency financial manager Joe Harris followed proper procedures under the old emergency manager law. The millage represented millions of dollars, roughly about 20% of Benton Harbor's budget. But it isn't clear what Harris plans to do about it yet. He has hinted at a special tax assessment for public safety operations, and he says he'll hold a press conference Monday to unveil his plans. That would be the first time that Harris has held a formal public meeting since the spring. Still to come, there's been no shortage of eye-popping headlines lately that all seem to revolve around text messages and emails. Have we still not learned how to interact appropriately in the digital age? That story in 15 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Honesty check now. Hands up. How many of us were driving today and while we were on the road, stopped somewhere to peek at a text message or an email, maybe even answer a text message or an email? Well, we have certainly heard countless warnings about the dangers of driving while distracted by a cell phone. So, why is it virtually impossible to resist the call of that little smartphone nestled in the cup holder next to you as you drive? NPR reporter Sonari Glinton got to wondering the very same thing as he logged so many miles driving around the Midwest covering the presidential election and catching himself peeking at his phone even though he knew better. Sonari joins us today along with someone who may have some insight into why we cave into the temptation to let those phones distract us behind the wheel. Dr. Paul Green, who is with the Driver Interface Group at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Welcome to both of you.
It's good to be here.
Oh, so Sonari, we know texting and driving is against the law in 39 states, plus the District of Columbia and some other territories.
Wow.
And yet, there you were.
Yeah, you know, I think part of it is, as our culture and in our jobs, we want to be responsive. Like, we want to, you know, you want to respond to your boss. You want to respond to your coworkers. You don't want to leave people hanging. So there is this desire to kind of stay connected, you know, like, oh, I'm away for 30 minutes, 40 minutes. What's building up in my inbox? What's going on? I mean, the thing is, I'm a grown up. So when I hear texting, people talk about texting, I'm like, I don't answer texts. I would never answer a text, but I might, you know, read an email from Ari Shapiro, which is like equally ridiculous for me to do. And I think because we want to be responsive to the people in our lives.
I think you've captured it very, very well, that there's this pressure to do more and to do it faster and to do it better. And there's this perception that driving is wasted time, and so therefore, well, let's do something in addition to driving. Unfortunately, you've spoken already about some of the consequences.
But even more than that, isn't that the fact that these phones have become, I think for most of us, an attachment of our bodies? We have all heard people in public restrooms chatting away because they couldn't go into the stall without carrying that. You leave the house, you think, I don't have my phone, I have to go back. Isn't it almost a sense that we see this as just an extension of us? Are we looking at our phones differently than our parents did?
I'd say the answer is yes. And you go, for example, to a place, I can remember a family event where there were some younger folks there, and we had a break between activities, and they were all on their phones, either texting somebody, emailing somebody, or playing some kind of game on the phone. There's this just sense that it's idle time, I have to do something.
Now that's but the thing is, there's one thing when you're, say, in a public bathroom,
yes,
or when you're with your family, you're not hurtling 60 miles an hour down the expressway.
Right, right. But then you're taking that extension and you're not seeing that as a distraction. It's just me getting in touch with my daughter or me getting in touch with the boss.
Yeah.
What distraction. And I will ask you to fess up because you did tweet the day after your story ran on NPR. Tell us what you tweeted.
Well, I'd stopped off to get coffee and a few pieces of salami at the gourmet shop. And my story had aired on Sunday. It's a Monday morning. I'm rolling into the stop sign. I go pick up my cell phone. I look, and it was an email from a professor from Massachusetts saying that he had heard my story about distracted driving.
And there you were.
And there I was reading my email about distracted. It was just like, what world am I living? Like, what am I doing? I threw the phone to the side and I didn't answer. I mean, I stopped and I realized how ridiculous that is.
Well, Dr. Green, I know you study driver behavior. Can you tell me, I think I am in this group, are there those of us who kind of play games with ourselves like, okay, I'm not going to text while I'm driving, but I might peek at an email or a text message while I'm stopped at a light? That's not distracted driving, or so we think. Is that a game of self-delusion?
I'd say the answer is yes. So Sonari made the point that, okay, he stopped at the light, but he doesn't know what he missed. And there could be a pedestrian coming, or there could be some other activity that immediately after the light changes he needs to know about. But because he's been focused on his cell phone, on some message or information, that he doesn't know what he missed. And that's the problem.
Boy, and as you say that, I remember when my daughter was taking driver's ed, the teacher called the intersection the kill zone.
Yes.
Which kind of made me go, wow. But you're right, because you are... Even if you're stopped with your foot on the brake, you're disengaged while you're looking down, right?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to ask you about something that I will say because I'm on the road a lot. Here's something I'll do. Text my daughter Siobhan's cell phone. So I'm using Siri, and I'll dictate the thing and send it off.
What do you want to say to Siobhan and Canty?
Way to go, period. Is using a Siri, or something voice-activated like that, okay, or do I need to quit? Seriously.
Okay. The research sometimes is on using voice interfaces is mixed.
Okay.
But it was interesting to watch you just a moment ago perform that interaction. There were a few things I noticed.
Yeah.
The first is you had to hold the phone in your hand.
Yeah.
So if you were driving, you would have one hand on the wheel, not two, which is generally not a good situation.
Okay. True.
The second is as you spoke, you cast your eyes to the ceiling to collect your thoughts about what you wanted to say. If you had been driving, I wonder if you would have been looking at the road at all.
Okay.
And those glances were not just brief glances away. They were long glances, which are particularly risky because that's when things that are bad happen.
Especially if I'm on I-96.
Yes.
So, Sonari, why is it, do you think, we can roundly condemn someone who has a few beers or glasses of wine or cocktails and gets behind the wheel of a car, but we indulge with phone fiddling?
Well, you know, we haven't gotten to that point where we sort of culturally said this is wrong. I mean, I remember as a kid in the 80s, I led my family to put on their seatbelts. I was a kid and I'd seen some horrible TV show, and then it became a thing. It became my own little personal campaign, and we were a little bit ahead of the curve. But as my family was wearing seatbelts, the whole sort of laws changed. the way people thought about it. They got, you know, it became illegal not to have your seatbelt on. And so people didn't want to be scoff laws, and the whole sort of culture sort of shifted. Same thing with drinking and driving. It's not just laws. It is culturally. Like, we say to each other, if you see a friend, if you're having a dinner party and your friend is overserved, I mean, like, A, you're personally liable, but there is a more cultural thing behind it. I'm like, I'm not going to let me call you a cab, or, you know, it is a cultural thing. We have decided. Now, if I say, oh, I was texting, everyone's like, eh, that's funny. Oh, yeah, I do the same thing. You know, like, we haven't gotten to that point in our culture where we say, this is dangerous. Mm-hmm. This is a bad thing to do. I should not be doing it. And neither should you.
What is behind the mindset of a driver that will look over and see someone texting or scrolling through the cell phone and just think, well, how could they do that? And then at the light, you're kind of looking yourself. There's almost this, it's his problem, but I can handle it. Is a little self-delusion there?
Yeah, there is. There's this impression among many people that, okay, I'm a better than average driver, but how can most people be better than average? It just defies these laws of statistics.
Yeah, I am. You're not the idiot. I'm the idiot. The fault is not in our stars, but in ourselves that we are underlings. Like, I'm the idiot. And you think that I can handle texting and driving better than somebody else. You're like, oh, I can do it. That teenage girl, the 38-year-old man goes, that teenage girl, she's a danger. But me, I'm not a danger. I've been driving for 20 years.
I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, but chances are I don't know what I'm doing.
We're talking about why we keep talking on our cell phones, checking emails and texting while we drive, even though we know we shouldn't. Sonari Glinton reported on the issue for NPR. And Paul Green is with us. He's a researcher who studies distracted driving. So what do you think it says about us as a society that we have put such inordinate amount of emphasis on staying in touch and using that smartphone even as we're driving along at 70 miles an hour on the freeway?
Well, I think we're just all under pressure to produce more in less time and to produce it better and faster. We've heard that message time and time again. You know, we're competing against the rest of the world. So therefore, any moment that we think is idle, that something else can be done, well, let's see what else we can cram in that time period.
Yeah, the idea that I'm going to be productive every single moment of every day. And one of the things that I don't think that people realize is sometimes being productive means not doing something. Like, sometimes the best thing you can do is just take 5 minutes and don't talk to anybody. Don't listen to the radio. Just go down the highway and pay attention to your surroundings. I've written whole stories on the road. I have come up with whole ideas that there is something vitally productive about quiet alone time. And it used to be that your car was an oasis. Mm-hmm. It used to be that it was a way to get away if you wanted to, you know, if you're mad with your parents or your girlfriend or whatever, you could get in your car and drive away. Now you're still tethered.
It's the rolling office.
And I hate to be a Luddite, but I think that there is something beautiful about driving a car and about being alone in your car. And I think we need to get a little bit of that back.
Right. And you might hear people say something like, I just need time to think. And that's what you're referring to.
Yeah. But somehow we in 2012 are unable to give ourselves permission to do that.
Yes. And I think there's another piece to it, which actually there's some research to support. And that is, if you're constantly tethered to your text messages and your email messages, your productivity actually suffers. And the reason is because you're engaged in some task and you get interrupted by that text message or email message that you feel you must instantly respond to, in which case you do. But then you say, now, where was I in writing this piece for this NPR story or something else? And it takes time to recover where you were. So, in fact, sometimes the important work is disrupted by that extraneous email message or text message.
So how about some personal resolutions? I know, Sonari, you have instituted some.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's. I think part of it is as a way to keep ourselves from texting and driving, I think it would be sort of silly to say, oh, I'm just going to throw my phone in the trunk and I'm not going to look at it. I mean, you could do that, and that would make it easy. But I don't know if a lot of people do that. So I think there are some steps you can take to sort of keep yourself from the temptation. One of the things is reenacting an old school thing, which is call your friends and family before you leave work. Say, you know, honey, I'm on my way home. Mm-hmm. Should I stop at the grocery store? What's going on? What should I know? So that, A, the person you're talking to knows that you're going to be on the road and that person will not call you. So then you don't feel like you have to respond.
Okay.
So if your husband knows that you're in the car, if your daughter knows you're in the car, then who else is important? Bosses and people who are in charge need to understand that, you know, when you send a reporter or you send a salesperson or whatever, that they're going to be on the road. So don't make email your primary communication. I've tried to let the people at work know, hey, my editors, my producers, look, I'm going to be on the road for 30 minutes. I'm going to be on the road for 2.5 hours. If it's really super important, you can call me.
Yeah.
I have the Bluetooth thing. It's not the best, but it's much better than the trifecta of dangers.
Is that true?
It's a little bit better.
You winced when he said it.
Yeah, it's a little bit better because there's not the manual activity handling the phone. So you're going to be safer that way, but there's still a lot of debate as to whether it's safe or not. There's another strategy that one might use, which is that when you call somebody, if you're calling them on a cell phone, you usually know that. And sometimes you can tell, like, oh, I think this sounds like they're driving. And you can simply say, are you driving now? And then you can say, well, my practice is not to distract people. I'm sorry I have to end this conversation. When can I call you back?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Can you give me a call when you're at rest, when you're someplace?
So it takes two. We can all on all, either side of the conversation.
That's right. So you can, if you believe it's a bad idea, you simply say, I really don't want to talk to you while you're driving. I don't want to be responsible potentially for you getting into a crash.
I just want to point out that Cynthia's cell phone went off. Then, like, right as you were saying that is you know what? If I were a producer, I that is beautiful.
It's
exactly.
So true. And I'm listening, but I had to say, boy, oh boy, lots and lots to think about. Sonari, thank you. And Dr. Green, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing insights today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sonari Glinton is an NPR reporter, and Paul Green is with the Driver Interface Group at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Let's continue looking at our relationship with technology. There's been no shortage of eye-popping headlines pouring out this week about now former CIA Director David Petraeus and General John Allen, commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. Emails, reportedly thousands of pages worth, filled with questionable communications between the generals and women to whom they are not married. Rings a bell, especially if you follow the news in Detroit, where former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick was toppled by the revelation of more than 14,000 often raunchy text messages exchanged between Kilpatrick and his chief of staff, Christine Beatty. On the national front, how about former New York Congressman Anthony Weiner sending out self-portraits via text? This got us wondering, have we still not figured out how to appropriately manage our technology, the smartphones and the email that have become an intimate part of our lives? Cliff Lampe is an assistant professor at the School of Information at the University of Michigan. Cliff, I'm wondering, what is going on here? Have we just not figured out yet how to manage communicating in the digital world?
I think it's a mix of things. I mean, our dominant model of communication is still face-to-face. And when we're in face-to-face contact, we have some established norms, and we have pretty good control over what we say and who can hear it. We tend to forget that these technologies have lots of other, what we call affordances, right? They have lots of other characteristics that's easy to forget. For instance, with an email, one thing that's easy to forget is that it's stored, right? That there's a record of that email, and that makes it findable by somebody else in the future. And because it's digital, it's copyable. So it's easy to make copies of these digital things. And this occurs both in kinds of emails and texts, but also in Facebook posts and Twitter posts, where we tend to forget some of these kind of technological characteristics of electronic communication, like that they're stored, like that they can be rebroadcast, or that the audience for them is so large sometimes.
It was quite astounding as we followed the whole unraveling of the Kwame Kilpatrick text message scandal. And clearly, when you read what the two of them were writing to each other, you know that it never occurred to them that the rest of the world would one day read these things as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's the technology doesn't really notify us that it's doing all these things under the hood, right? It doesn't tell you, hey, by the way, this is making a record of this crazy thing you're saying to your girlfriend here. So it's easy for us to forget that it's not face-to-face communication sometimes, because it feels often very intimate, these things that we say to one another in these electronic channels. But somewhere a computer is storing those things, and it's replicable and sendable by somebody else.
Cliff, what do you think it says about us in 2012? This technology is not brand new, but it is certainly still rearing its head. So here in 2012, what does it say about us?
Well, it says that we are in a very rich environment with lots of different ways of communicating with our friends and family and colleagues. And sometimes the variety of ways that we have to communicate can be confusing for people. It also means that we still have a ways to go in terms of designing and building technologies that help us to manage these things.
So the takeaway for the powerful and the not so powerful as we read all of these headlines this week would be?
Take a breath before you hit send and think about what's being stored and who could potentially see this in the future.
Thank you so much, Cliff.
You bet.
Cliff Lampe is with the School of Information at the University of Michigan. Still ahead, Detroit as a model for American competitiveness? One Harvard professor thinks so. We'll find out why in 10 minutes. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Gambling is big, big business in Michigan. With 23 casinos open for business, plus the state lottery and horse racing, it's an almost $4 billion industry. This summer, the Michigan Supreme Court ordered off the ballot a proposal that would have allowed 8 new casinos into Michigan's constitution. But an effort to build a casino in downtown Lansing continues. Michigan's Attorney General Bill Schutte filed a lawsuit in September challenging the right of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians to build a casino right down the street from the state's capital. Steve Carmody has been following the story for Michigan Radio. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
So Attorney General Bill Schutte says the Lansing Casino Project would violate federal law as well as a gaming compact with the state. Can you tell us how so?
Well, the Attorney General maintains that the basic framework of this casino project, since it's not taking place on sovereign Indian land, would violate the 1988 Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which is the federal law. And also, it would violate a 1993 gaming compact between the state and the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe. And that compact covers revenue sharing. The tribe already operates 5 casinos up in the UP in its traditional area, but this would definitely be outside of where the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians is normally, you know, considered to be located.
Now, the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe says this lawsuit that's trying to prevent them from building a Lansing casino is, in their words, utterly without merit. So what is their argument?
Well, their argument is that they have a land claim exemption as part of the 1997 Michigan Indian Land Claims Settlement Act, which they say gives them the ability to acquire this land, and then they can move forward with it. They're not saying it necessarily that gives them the full exemption for the casino project, but it does allow them to acquire the land and then submit the land for trust to the Department of the Interior, which would then, you know, hold the land title for the tribe while the tribe moves forward with its casino project.
Where do they want to build this project? Whereabouts in Lansing?
Right in the heart of what the city says they want to have as their entertainment district. It would wrap around, essentially, the Lansing Center, which is the city's downtown convention center. It's right across the street from the city's minor league ballpark, and it would be within sight of the state capitol building, which is about a half mile or so away.
Now, the tribe and the city, they've shaken hands. They've got a deal, right? What's in this deal?
At this point, what the deal is that the city and some private developers and the tribe have all agreed for a land transfer of multiple parcels, different parcels of land that surround the downtown convention center. And the tribe will develop that land along with the private developers, building what they hope to be would be a $245 million casino. The casino would not have a hotel, but it would be an entertainment venue. And the city is hoping that would, of course, create many construction jobs and eventually a lot of entertainment industry jobs in downtown. The other advantage for the city is that revenue from the casino would fund a education program that would help local Lansing school children get college scholarships. And, of course, the other benefit for the city would be a large, what they hope would be a large draw for their downtown convention center, which at the moment is not generating revenue. It's more of a drag on the city's finances.
And actually, that stretch along there is kind of anemic. I'm sure the city's looking at it, and they'd love to see more life along that stretch.
This part of Lansing is slowly developing, growing. It's got something of a bar scene, the nightclub scene. As I said before, it has the ballpark just down the way. It has the convention center, but it doesn't have a big draw to bring in a lot of people from out of town.
So, Steve, what should we expect to see happen next?
Well, at this point, we're in the litigation phase of what will be a very litigious project. The federal court that is currently reviewing the request from the state to stop this project from moving forward, that'll probably go before a federal judge sometime in December. If the judge doesn't stop the project there, the tribe will then submit the land to the Department of the Interior, asking them to take it into trust. And at that point, things really get litigious because the state will probably file another lawsuit, and other tribes that operate casinos here in mid-Michigan are also expected to file legal challenges to that, the Department of Interior taking the land into trust. This whole legal challenge phase is expected to take maybe up to 2 years. The tribe is hopeful that they have the law on their side, that they'll be able to push this through. The other tribes that are opposing this casino, they feel, along with the state, that this would not be legal under the state or federal laws.
So it seems that no one should be making any plans for a gaming trip to Lansing anytime in the near future.
Don't bet on it.
Steve Carmody, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Steve Carmody is Michigan Radio's Mid-Michigan reporter. Meanwhile, we should mention a bill to help Michigan's struggling horse racing industry is on its way to the state Senate. The legislation would let us bet on races from years ago. Players would place bets, and then a randomly selected race would be shown. The State House passed the bill last week with bipartisan support. The Detroit Three car makers a big, big pat on the back saying, job well done. That's the goal of an event being held tomorrow night at the Henry Ford Museum. It's being put on by the Harvard Business School, arguably one of the nation's premier business schools. They're presenting their case study called The Big Three Roar Back, examining the turnaround of the American auto industry. Harvard Business School Professor William George will be among those participating in the panel, and he joins us now. Welcome, Bill.
Good to be with you.
I dare say it's going to gladden a lot of hearts here in the Detroit area to know that your case study is entitled The Big Three Roar Back, because really it wasn't long ago that so many feared the domestic car industry was on life support in the intensive care unit. What impresses you most about the big turnaround?
Well, let me just give you a little background. I grew up in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, actually, on the west side of the state, where we were basically suppliers to the Big Three. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine an American world where we wouldn't have a strong domestic automobile industry. And the idea that we would just let General Motors and Chrysler disappear from the face of the earth is kind of beyond me. I'm not big on government bailouts, I assure you, but I think it's so important to see this tremendous comeback. And our team at Harvard, led by Professors Michael Porter and Jan Rifkin, is looking very hard at U.S. competitiveness. And frankly, this is the very best example that I can find anywhere in the United States of a whole industry that was on its back and is coming back to high levels of competitiveness. It happens to be a unionized industry and is doing it with that understanding with the leaders of the UAW. And I think it's an example of how to get to win-win solutions that are going to win for the company's customers, for the employees, and also for the shareholders.
And it's really looking at what was done both by management and the union workforce.
Well, you know, I think, and I look at the first one who initiated this, of course, was Alan Mulally of Ford. And Alan came from Boeing, and he initiated, along with Bill Ford, discussions with the leaders, Ron Gettelfinger and Bob King of the UAW, discussions about, hey, we have to get serious about being competitiveness with foreign imports, with foreign production plants in the South, if you will, different parts of the country. And if we can't be competitive, you know, frankly, you're either going to lose all our business or it's all going to migrate offshore. And I think there were some very clear plans put in place. This started back in 2007. And I think ever since then, there's been this heightened awareness of the importance of design, quality, and, you know, cost competitiveness. You know, the fallout, as you know, not just in your area, but all over the Midwest is tremendous in terms of all the suppliers, everyone there, the dealers around the country, around the world. It's the backbone of the country, and the idea that we're going to be a post-industrial society and we're just going to do service industries, everyone making $10 to $12 an hour, is just a non-starter as far as we're concerned.
As part of the restructuring that took place, and you kind of alluded to this, we definitely saw a major rollback in wages for new hires in the auto industry. Was that a totally necessary step?
I think it was. I think that gave Ford the confidence we can bring small cars back. For a while, it looked like the automobile industry was going the route of we'll just make trucks and SUVs. And as Alan Mulally told me, he said, no, we have to have a full line. How can we go to any dealer and say, okay, you know, you're going to have to go to Japan and get your cars, and we'll provide the trucks and the SUVs. Okay, there's more profit in there, but I think they found a way to be competitive, and I think that was essential. But that did require a collaborative spirit, and I found in talking to Bob King for this case, a real collaborative spirit and a real commitment. We want quality products. You know, we want to ensure that the products are quality, and we want to ensure management is investing in the equipment to give our workers the help and really appreciates we can work together. Because, frankly, who knows better about the quality of the automobile than people doing the work? You know, I used to say it, you know, back in my days as CEO of Medtronic. You know, it's the people doing the work that are coming up with the innovative ideas, providing quality in our products. They're the ones that we need to honor. And I think there has been that commitment. And I think you're seeing this is the backbone of the turnaround.
We're talking with Harvard Business School professor Bill George, who's going to be among a panel participating in this panel discussion being put on by the Harvard Business School. And it's looking at the success of the U.S. auto industry. Their case study is called The Big Three Roar Back. And Bill, in most cases, there are winners and losers in any restructuring. In your opinion, who are the winners and losers in the Detroit 3 restructuring and turnaround?
Well, surely the shareholders lost. And I think the bondholders lost. But in Ford, I can't say that anyone really lost because they never went through bankruptcy.
Right.
And because of the wisdom of Alan Mulally and his CFO, they implemented a plan to borrow some $23.5 billion to help the company through the difficult times. And because of that, now that money's almost entirely been paid back now, that got them through there. But anytime you go through bankruptcy, there are going to be winners and losers. And frankly, I know that many of the leaders would like to get out from under the ownership of the federal government, and I hope that that will occur. But I think in the long run, you can say we all took some hits. That's true. But I think it's a question we have a short-term view and a long-term view. And if you have too much of a short-term view, you won't be a long-term. And so I think by taking some short-term steps, now they're taking very important long-term steps. And there's no question that the quality of the cars improved, the design has improved, they're more competitive, consumers are happier. That's why share has been going up. And in part, they got a bit of a break because of Toyota's problems, and Toyota's coming back now. It's a great company and a great competitor, but it restored that, whereas particularly General Motors had lost 60% of its market share, and you
right.
can't do that.
Right.
That means 60% fewer people want to buy your cars. And for whatever reason, and I don't think it was just price, I think it was more just a question of being competitive in every regard. So when you say you're going to be competitive, it's got to be, we have the best designs. Why should the Germans have all the engineering? You know, we have the best designs, the best quality, and affordable cars across a full line.
You talked about the short-term and the long-term view of things. And let's take a long-term view. And let me ask you, how strong and lasting do you think this turnaround is? Is this a recovery that we can count on and we know it's going to be there in the long term?
I actually do, because steps are being taken to ensure the long-term viability. The capital is being put in. The plants are being built. The cars, the design. You can't just turn out same old kind of automobiles with a few changes. You've got to get ahead to what consumers of the future are going to want. I think one of the most dramatic steps taken, and I credit the leaders, of the big three for doing this, and was to improve the CAFE standards, which for decades has been resisting. Fuel efficiency is going to be important in the future, and the fact they're going to double those standards between now and 2025 is stunning to me.
Mm-hmm.
The best source of energy in this country, I can tell you, is efficiency. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Much more so than renewables. Maybe in 30, 40 years, the renewables will take a much bigger role, but right now it's a limited role. But this efficiency is critical because people are going to be sensitive. They're paying $4 a gallon. You know, they want to get mileage. And I think for a while, Detroit had ceded that to the Japanese and to some of the Europeans. I think that's now on a full, more than equal footing. And so I'm very pleased to see, rather than letting the federal government dictate, in this case, the leaders actually took the lead on it, getting it done.
Bill, now that Detroit's auto industry is on a healthier road, what industry are you concerned about for the future? Who's in a precarious position, in your opinion?
Well, we've had a lot in a precarious position,
yeah.
That we've kind of bid goodbye to. And some of them, honestly, won't come back, like textiles. It's a tragedy, but we've lost that industry. High-tech industries must be competitive in this country, because that's the strength of the American entrepreneurship and the American strength. So I'm optimistic. I think banking still has to come forward and say how they're helping the people and not just making money for themselves. And there's so much anger out there. We've got to get past that point, and we're wasting it. My biggest concern is healthcare, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very, very concerned about healthcare. And I think we, even in Detroit, where we have very generous health benefits for workers, it's not viable the way the costs are going. We've got to get at the root causes of poor health. And so that would probably be my number one that I would be most concerned about. The one last thing I'd like to say is that I think Detroit can be a model for the competitiveness of America. And America's got a long way to go, and that's what we're interested in. Is this, and we want to come there to say, can this become a model for every other industry in this country?
Lessons that America can learn from the Detroit Three carmakers about competitiveness, and all being focused on a panel on Thursday evening at the Henry Ford Museum, put on by the Harvard Business School. And we've been talking with Harvard Business School Professor William George, the Big Three roaring back. Thanks for talking with us today, Professor George.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your support of this. We are very delighted to see that there's this level of interest.
Thank you, Professor. Let's end today with a story that caught our eye. Governor Rick Snyder says state government employees are indeed answering his call for ideas to help improve efficiency and customer service. Today, the governor's office announced top submissions in an effort known as Bureaucracy Busters. This idea is based in part on the popular TV show Mythbusters. More than 8,000 state employees came up with ideas to save Michigan some time and money. Winning ideas included cutting down on the number of passwords to access employee websites and adding names of the scenic locations and photos on the Pure Michigan marketing campaign billboards. The next phase of Bureaucracy Busters will invite state employees to vote on one of several problems that they want to help solve. We'll have a link to Bureaucracy Busters on our webpage at michiganradio.org. As always, here at Stateside, we love connecting with you. We are on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Offer up comments or suggest a story. We always want to hear from you. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineer today by Bob Scon. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.